In the 1970s and 80s, he terrorized California and is suspected of at least 12 murders and at least 50 rapes. Now police say the suspected Golden State Killer has been caught 40 years after his horrific crime spree. 72-year-old Joseph DeAngelo was caught after cold case detectives tracked him down through DNA submitted by a relative through a genealogy website. Let's talk more about this case with Carol Daly, a retired Sacramento County Sheriff's Office detective who led the investigation into the East Area rapist, also known as the Golden State Killer. Carol, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Now, before the news broke to the public, you got a call about an arrest being made in the case after all this time. How did it feel to get that news?
I was on my way home from spending an afternoon with my granddaughter, and the phone rang, and I saw that it was Sheriff Scott Jones. And so, actually, my first impression was, maybe somebody got arrested and used my name, and because that has happened. So, he says, Carol, he said, we want you to be one of the first to know. He said, we've just arrested the East Area rapist. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, no. He said, we have arrested the East Area rapist. And I said, oh, my gosh. And he said, we're going to have a press conference tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. And we just want you to make, you know, to be aware so it doesn't blindside you. And I said, you have to call the victims. These victims have to know as many of them as possible before the news hits the media. And he said, I said, you know, I had maintained contact with several of the victims. And I said, may I go ahead and call some of them to let them know? And he said, absolutely. And shortly after that, District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert called and said, Carol, can you put it off until tomorrow morning? Because we're doing search warrants and we want to make sure that nothing gets out, you know, until we get a lot of our work done. And I said, good. And so I hung up and I went on Facebook, and already there was information circulating that they had a possible suspect in the East Area rapist. And the next few times it was, oh, I think they've taken him into custody. And then on Facebook, oh, they've arrested him. Oh, by the way, here's his name. And so it was, it went like wildfire. And so early the next morning, I was able to call and speak with about six of the victims.
And what did those victims say to you when you told them?
Oh, my goodness. It was just overwhelming. The first couple I called, I did call before I got the phone call from the district attorney. And they were a couple I knew that would keep it very confidential. They were both victims in the attack. They were in the home together. And tears. And the wife said, I am going to be able to sleep tonight. So it was just after 40 years to be able to say that I am finally going to be able to sleep through the night was very telling about what the victims have gone through.
And for you, what toll did it take on you that you never got that guy and you had to retire without walking him into the jail?
Oh, it was the case. There has not been a night go by that I have not thought about the East Area rapist before I went to sleep. The pressure in the community, the pressure even within law enforcement that was put on us to try to apprehend the rapist was unbelievable. And when the rapes first started, Sheriff Lowe chose not to go public. He said, we're going to catch the guy, and then we're going to have a big press conference and say, you know, yay, we got this guy. But as the rapes went on, we didn't apprehend him. So the one of the owners or big managers of Livermore Laboratories, his daughter was going to school here at Sac State, and he had heard about that there was a possible rapist on the loose, and he was concerned for the safety of his daughter. So he came to Sacramento, spoke to Sheriff Lowe, and along with some other businessmen that he brought with him, and told him, you have to go public with this. You have to let people know what is going on. We need to make sure everybody can take care of themselves. And so the sheriff promised that he would make sure that every time we had a rape or anything new, that it would go to the media. We had two newspapers at the time. We had the Sacramento Bee and we had the Sacramento Union. And so the rapes were then made public. And of course, each time they were made public, it was with a number, you know, number 7, number 8, number 12, number 15, number 23. And it just added fuel to the fear that the public was having. So at that time, there was a tremendous amount of pressure. And I remember, you know, in the public, people would say, haven't you caught him yet? What are you doing to catch him? And then towards, as the rapes continued and continued, I came into work one day, pushed the button to go up in the elevator to my office, and an officer walked by and he said, haven't you guys caught that guy yet? And I thought, you know what? Everybody was frustrated. Everybody was tired of hearing about the East Area Rapist and the fact that we hadn't been able to apprehend him.
Talk about just what the mood was. Obviously, you said the fear. I could only imagine what the community was going through while these cases continued.
Oh, it was prior to this, Sacramento was just a little quiet community. People didn't lock their doors. They left their windows open. You could, you know, you didn't have to lock your car. You could pull in the driveway. You didn't have to worry about things. Once the word got out about the East Area Rapist and the fear in the community, because he was a very violent rapist, and because his MO was so different than any other rapist that I had ever, any other cases that I had ever worked. So locks, you know, flew off out of the hardware stores. People were putting in alarms. And at that time, we didn't have really sophisticated alarms. And people would put in an alarm with a button that would go directly to, you know, law enforcement. Some of the alarms at that time were just pads, you know, pressure pads that you walk on. And the gun sales soared. Everybody was arming themselves. You know, if they didn't have a gun, they had a knife, they had a billy club, they had a big rod, they had something that they felt they could use to defend themselves with.
We have Mr. D'Angelo now, the suspect in the case, captured. From what you're learning, how confident are you that this is the guy?
Oh, I'm confident it is. I have total confidence in the current investigators who have worked the case, you know, the statewide task force, all of the information coming in. I'm confident it is him through the match in the DNA. And it's interesting that you asked me that question. How confident am I that it is him? I have talked to three or four of the victims who have called me since the arrest. And just yesterday, they're saying, Carol, is the DNA going to hold him? Is this going to be him? Is he going to get out? Is the DNA not going to be held up? Is he going to get out? And I have tried to assure them that the DNA is good. The DA would not have gone forward with the arrest unless they knew that, you know, they were going to be able to overcome any challenge to that. But I said, on top of that, you know, with the search warrant and all of the things that they took out of that house, I said, just stay hopeful that there are mementos. Maybe there are guns that are going to match up with ballistics. There's all kinds of other things than DNA. But the victims have had so much fear because there's so much information in the media right now about DNA and how it is used and whether or not law enforcement can use it. And so this is a fear that the victims now have, is that maybe the DNA won't be upheld in court and this guy will go free. I told him, don't worry about it. This guy is not going to go free.
Mr. D'Angelo, did he ever pop up on your radar during your investigation?
Never in the 40 years of officers investigating this case in all of the multi-jurisdictions where the rapist attacked and then killed his victims down in Southern California, not once did his name ever come up on the radar. We weren't even close. We had a lot of really good suspects. We had suspects that matched the profile, that matched the physical description, that matched all of the areas that he could have been in. And then they were all eliminated. You know, we'd get excited and then we'd be let down. We'd get excited and then we would be let down for 40 years. This case never went uninvestigated. You know, once things calmed down after the murders, and there were no more cases, like in 86, I think was the last one. It never just sat on a shelf and wasn't investigated. There were always cold case investigators looking at it, following up on tips. The FBI was following up on tips. You know, you had people writing books about it. So it never went cold. But about 2 years ago, when District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert made it a concerted effort to start, you know, working with the DNA and forming a statewide task force, and the FBI came out with their $50,000 reward, that was when everything came into focus again in the media, even though the case had never been forgotten. You had investigators who had retired and continued with their private investigator license, continued to work this case and hunt down suspects. So it was never what I call a cold case. It had always been in the forefront of people's minds.
And this suspect, a former police officer, if he is the guy, do you think his knowledge of how the investigative process works helped him avoid capture?
Absolutely. And by the time we had worked several of the rapes, we felt, I mean, he knew everything we were doing. So if we said he hadn't done this, the next thing, it was everything that we said in the paper was a challenge for him to do again. So victim alone, well, never anybody else in the house. Jane Carson, victim number five, her son was with her, but there had not been another man in the house. Next thing, you know, next rape we had, there was a couple in the house. So he played off in the media. He played off from, you know, I don't know what kind of radio access he might have had. You know, at the time you didn't have the sophistication of communications like you have now. You know, we have walkie talkies and it was back in the dark ages. It wasn't like it is now. So yes, we had some suspicion that he might have been a cop. We had suspicions that he might have been military. And I thought, okay, if he's full-time working, how does he have all of this time to prowl? How does he have time to stay up all night and do these rapes and then, you know, go to work the next day? Was it on his days off? I meant there were a lot of things that made us suspect that he might have been in law enforcement. I mean, we had no idea. It was just that he knew everything we were doing. And when you cross jurisdictions, it complicates investigations. So early on, we'd had 10 rapes in Sacramento County. Then he went over to Sacramento Police Department, which was city jurisdiction. Then he came back into the county. Rape number 18, he goes back into city police department jurisdiction. Number 23, he goes down to Stockton. Number 30, he goes down to Stockton. And after that, he was completely out of our jurisdiction. The last rape that we had in the city or county of Sacramento was rape number 31, which was walking distance from my home.
Wow. And you were the face of this investigation. You talked about how he acted on what he heard and what hadn't been done. Did you ever have any fears for your safety because you were up there talking and trying to find him actively?
I don't think I ever experienced any fear. I had it was the stress of answering questions from the public, trying to help the victims through it, trying to concentrate on everything that we had to do. My husband and I were both in law enforcement. He was a SWAT sergeant on the department, and he was leading a lot of field officers who were working, in patrol and behind doing all of the street work, tracking down prowlers and looking at people and watching and trying to apprehend him. So we worked opposite shifts and we had opposite days off, and so. It wasn't just me on this case. It was, you know, my husband. So it was our whole life at that time. And I don't think I ever had any fear. Was I cautious? Yes. And I had gone prior to getting the news, anytime I had to go out at night if I got called to a hospital with a family member or anything, I always, you know, we always had lights on all around our property to keep it light. So when we went to, you know, when I went to the car, I could see everything. And after I had gotten the news that night, I had previously had made arrangements to take our pastor's wife and two other ladies to the airport with a whole bunch of luggage in a wheelchair care for a child in Cuba. And so I said, oh, no problem. I've got a big, you know, I have a big Tahoe. I can put all of everything in there. I'll pick you up. So I had to pick them up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so it was after I had received the news. And I tell you what a different feeling walking out of my house, knowing that I wasn't going to come face to face with anybody, you know, especially the East Area Rapist. You know, all these years, we've had this face, this young face in the media. And all of these years, when we think about the East Area Rapist, we always thought about somebody who was young, who was agile, was able to do all of these things. And it was just so surreal to see him arrested and know that he's just 5 years younger than me. So he's an old man. So a lot of emotions and things going. It's just some. At first, it was hard to compute and to bring into reality. And I think even now, I'm with some of the victims. Is it still real? So I understand, you know, how a lot of people in the community feel. They're relieved. Probably the younger generation may have heard about it from their parents. But let me tell you, anybody in their 40s, 50s, 60s, you talk about the East Area Rapist, all of them. Oh, I remember. I lived in the neighborhood. Oh, I remember this. Oh, I remember that. And they very real. People in law enforcement, whether you were with the Sheriff's Department, City Police Department, whether you were with the Department of Justice, whether you were with the FBI, whether you were with a Central Intelligence Agency, everybody at that time knew about the East Area Rapist because we had a concerted effort to everybody working together, and many of us band together to go to each one of the crime scenes so that everybody, we had a district attorney, we had an FBI agent, we had a criminalist, we had the officers, we had our CSI officers, the same people responding to the scenes all the time. So it was really a concerted effort all through the years to try to apprehend this guy.
And I have to ask, in the 80s, he abruptly ended his terror spree. Any ideas from what you're gathering on why that may have happened?
A lot of people thought, okay, he's in prison. You know, that maybe he moved away. My feeling had always been that he wasn't able. I never felt he went to prison because they did DNA on everybody in prison, and that was, here again, another concerted effort by District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert. And when we couldn't find anybody in prison, she was ready to go to the dead files of prisoners to try to go through their DNA to see if he died in prison. I never felt he had been arrested or had gone to prison. I felt he lost his ability to control his victims, to run, to jump fences. You know, that was the other thing. I mean, he went over 6-foot fences like nothing flat. I mean, he could run, he could hide. He disappeared into thin air. When patrol officers thought they had seen him, they would turn around, they would go back, and he was like a puff of smoke in the air. He was gone.
Wow.
So I think he lost his ability. I have since learned that he became very heavy, you know, from people that in the neighborhood that knew him. And I think he just lost his ability. And he came so close. And that was why he killed his last victims, is because he was losing control and he had to kill them.
Due to the law at the time of the attacks, the statute of limitations has run out for the rape cases here. So it appears the murder cases are what prosecutors must rely on. How confident are you that they have enough at their disposal to get convictions?
I'm confident. I mean, if we went back to a couple of the cases, maybe you could put a kidnapping in there because he moved him from the house to the backyard or from the front yard into the house. So, I mean, those are weak. But no, I'm confident that the homicide cases are going to be what is going to put him in prison.
And finally, any doubts that this day would ever come until it did?
Oh, I just probably 2 or 3 days before we got the news that he had been arrested, I had sent an email. I stayed in touch with Lieutenant Richard Shelby. He wrote the book, Chasing a Psychopath. We were partners for a while, and so we had stayed in touch, sharing information about what was the latest and what were the latest tips and everything. And I sent him an email, and I said, Richard, if we don't catch him by January of 2019, he's never going to be caught. And he said, I think I agree with you. And then 2 or 3 days later, we get the call that he'd been arrested.
And that's Carol Daly, a retired Sacramento County Sheriff's Office detective who led the investigation so many years ago into the East Area Rapist, also known as the Golden State Killer, a man police believe they have